All right. My name is Barrett Wessel. I'm a PhD student with Marty Ravenhorst at the University of Maryland. We did this work with Philip King, the state soil scientist for D.C., Maryland, and Delaware. We're going to be presenting on the stability, sampling, and subaqueous soils of the Rogue River estuary. Not everybody is really familiar with subaqueous soils. I should hope everybody's at least heard of them by now, but I'll give you a brief introduction. Subaqueous soils were pioneered by George Demas, an old soil mapper. He would map wetland soils, and one day, as the story goes, he got to the edge of a wetland on the far shore of Maryland and looked into the shallow water there and saw the submerged aquatic vegetation growing, saw the clams and crabs scuttling about, and just said, well, why do we stop right here? You know, that looks like soil as well. There's plants. There's a complex ecosystem going. Sure, it's overlain by a thick layer of water, but underneath it, you've got this complex solid substrate on which everything seems to depend. So he built on the 1970s expansion of soil into wetlands, and in the 1990s pushed that into shallow water as well, which resulted in the 1998 change to soil taxonomy. There were other changes in there, but part of it was to include submerged soil in up to about 2.5 meters of water. Since then, maps of subaqueous soils and subaqueous soil mapping in general has been expanded throughout coastal lagoons up and down the East Coast. A little bit of work in the Gulf Coast of Texas, and even recently some work in Italy. So it's starting to go global, which is good to see. The U.S. Federal Geographic Data Committee also recommends soil taxonomy for use when very detailed benthic maps are required. There are other benthic mapping techniques, but soil taxonomy is recognized as being one of the best. My work does take place in the Chesapeake Bay, specifically by this little red donut, but I'll give you a bit of information about the bay first. It's about 4,500 square miles, drains a very large watershed that extends partway up into New York and all the way down into Virginia. Maybe not quite as big as the Mississippi watershed. I know where I am, so I can't say it's the biggest and best, but it's sizable. It's a very badly degraded natural resource. Seagrass extent has dropped back quite a bit. That's where it was in 1965, all the green areas. In 2000, there's hardly any left. And most of what we see now is ephemeral. It comes and goes with the seasons. These were permanent beds back in 65. Huge extents of it. They refer to them as meadows, which is, you know, to anybody who's visited Maryland and looked at the water, you don't see meadows today under there. Crab populations have dropped off, other fisheries as well, and oysters also. Back in 1880, oyster harvest was about 120 million pounds, and now it's down to less than a million some years, or a couple million, best case scenario. Oyster reefs used to be navigation hazards in the bay, and the oysters used to be the size of dinner plates. Nothing like that exists today. The population would be completely extirpated if it weren't for continual stocking by human efforts. And so that's why it's important to map these soils to get a better idea of where we should be siting these restoration activities. The limited funds that we do have to plant oyster reefs and submerged aquatic vegetation need to be targeted, ideally, in order to get the best results. This is the existing sediment map of the Rogue River. You can see that they've broken it down into mud sand, and shell reef. Having been out there for a summer, I can tell you none of these shell reefs exist anymore. I don't know what map they pulled those off of, but it's all that's gone. The sub-estuary is about 1,000 acres. It's similar to a lot of other sub-estuaries along the Chesapeake Bay. The existing map isn't really suitable for what's going on. Maryland has an oyster leasing program whereby watermen can lease a little area of the bottom, and as long as they don't interfere with the boats going over that spot, they're free to come and go and to plant oyster shells and oysters, and they have the exclusive right to harvest oysters from that spot. So these maps can do a lot to help them with their livelihoods and with this restoration. The Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, part of the Smithsonian Institution, is located right about here. And we've got a collaborator there who wanted a high-quality map specifically of this estuary and is willing to give us a little help in getting everything we need to make it happen. So our proposal is more or less the standard pedologic proposal in these situations to delineate landforms using bathymetric maps instead of topo maps, select transects and describe soil cores along them, come up with pedogenic models for the Chesapeake Bay that we can hopefully expand into other sub-estuaries, and specifically really test what we produce in this sub-estuary and another one slightly to the south, the West River sub-estuary. But in order to do any of this, the first step really, we need high-quality bathymetric maps. So the objectives here, really the most important one for everybody in this room, I think, that I want you to take away is to evaluate the suitability of historic bathymetric maps for pedological work. There's a lot of maps with soundings that have been made over the years, over the centuries, honestly, particularly in the East Coast. Some go all the way back to the 1700s, maybe earlier, with the British Admiralty charts. I haven't been able to find any of those for the Road River yet. But to evaluate those, to see if they can be used, if they can be adapted, if they have really the information that we need as pedologists to map soils within these systems. And to determine maybe how old of a map is too old to get an idea of sedimentation rates and an idea of, you know, based on agriculture and sedimentation, when we might not be able to use those maps. So we had some existing bathymetry. Our methods really started with a paper map we got from our Smithsonian collaborator from 1972. It was hand-drawn. It's a photocopy. No one even knows where the original is. It's this giant rolled-up map. We scanned it. We started digitizing it. It had a little bit of metadata, one random page out of a written report along with the photocopy, which had just enough information on it to actually dig up the original references through NOAA and the National Ocean Service, a part of NOAA, that actually produced that map and many other maps along the coasts of the United States, and really comprehensive written reports that go with those maps. And so after quite a bit of searching, I finally found the original. I found digitized data for the 1972 map, as well as a 1933 map, and references and paper copies of a 1903 and 1846 map, although I don't have enough metadata on those to even know where the plane of reference was that the depths are relative to, because this is a tidal system. You've got to have that standard if you're going to be able to use that information. The National Ocean Service reports recommend mapping every 50 years. They saw that much stability, so we wanted to go through and do a comparison of these maps and see if we agreed with that. Really, the key point is we have to evaluate that stability before we can justify scaling up subaqueous soil mapping throughout the Chesapeake Bay. These are just some images of the maps, the 1846, 1903, and 1972 maps, and to those we've added some 2015 bathymetry. For that new bathymetry, we used a Garmin sonar model. Our departmental engineer built this rig that allowed us to move it from boat to boat so that we could get into the shallows and deep areas wherever we needed to for the most part. It collected location, depth, and time. The Smithsonian Institution there maintains a tide gauge, and with a tide gauge, you can create little polynomial functions for little chunks of the day that you're out in the water collecting data and correct everything back to a standard plane of reference. And so with that plane of reference and all this information, we can make a variety of digital elevation models for these maps and look at transects along those maps. It's just to give you an idea of the sampling density, how much work went into these surveys. The 1933 survey, 3,600 soundings. The 1972 had 4,300 roughly. In the 2015 work I did, I swear I wasn't drunk when I was driving the boat around doing this, we had 23,000 soundings. The new technology is really incredible. Back in 1933, they were working with a stick, and the 1800s, when they had a sextant. 72, they had a fathometer. We're not sure how it compares to our fathometer, but ours certainly collects quite a bit more data. And again, all that data is available at data.noaa.gov. It's a treasure trove of information that our community, I don't think, is really taking advantage of right now. These are the digital elevation models. They've got the same color scheme and the same scale. In order to produce these, I took those historic points, corrected them to the right projection, got the NOAA shoreline, cut the section we needed, converted that into points from the line, assigned a depth of zero to those points, aggregated the data, produced the DEMs, and clipped it using the original shoreline. You can see that, in general, it's gotten a little bit deeper as time has gone. The darker section here along the Thalweg, slightly more intense than earlier, and even up here in this tributary, too, you can see it's getting a little deeper as time goes by. Here are the three transects we took, just to show you a little bit of what we've been working on. This big cove here, this is the deepest section, and then between two islands here, transect number three. And just to go back, you can see that this island has disappeared. The dark gray is where we have land. We've got three islands, by 2015 only two, and a shoal, although really it's a wave cut platform. So they're marked a little strangely, just a closer view of those. This is transect number one. Try to ignore what you see on the far shore here. This green line is going to be off a little bit because of safety concerns in getting the boat within this particular area and taking a depth sounding there. You can see that these are very similar, largely within the air bars. The 2015 is a little deeper in the center. Maybe a little bit of change on the shore, although again, it's hard to tell on this side. These are in meters going across from, west to east. Transect number two, the deepest section goes down to about 4.5 meters at the deepest. Again, you can see along the center. At first I thought this was a little bit of scour, but I've had second thoughts since then. We've seen some change over here. This we did have data points on, so we're not sure exactly what we're looking at there. And the other side, more or less we see what we'd expect to see, a lot of stability in these systems. And transect number three, this is where we see the most change because, of course, at this end we've got High Island, which no longer exists, although Flat Island still does exist. Again, there was a sandbar that sort of prevented us from safely taking the boat into that area. This should, in fact, be shallower, so there's not much going on there besides an artifact in the data collection. Although you can see quite a bit more of a difference here with the 2015 up to that point. It's a little bit deeper, perhaps half a meter. And, of course, by 2015, the island was gone. And so, again, at first I thought that this was scour and shoreline erosion, and after thinking and going back to the reports, I realized it was probably relative sea level rise. The back-of-the-envelope calculations for sea level rise in the Chesapeake Bay over the past 80 years are about 30 centimeters. About 15 centimeters of that is actually due to sea level rise, and the other half is due to land subsidence. And if you were to cut 30 centimeters out of this, you would erase almost all of the difference between these lines and certainly bring us within the air bars. So our conclusion is, fortunately, that these landforms are very stable. Maps produced should be useful for possibly far more than 50 years. And these data sets can really be of a lot of use to our community, barring that issue with plane of reference and tying them in with topographic data sets surrounding the watersheds, which is work yet to be done. So moving forward, I'm going to do more bathymetry and sedimentation work, digitize the 1903 and 1846 bathymetric maps, spend some time in the archives, try to find descriptive reports or letters to do with these maps, compare total sediment volumes. We're hoping when we go back far enough, we really will start to see some changes due to agricultural and land use changes in the area, and correct for sea level rise in that data. And of course, the other part of the project is to complete the soil survey of the Road River using the VibraCore that we've got and my crew on the RV Wasent, and to start popping open these cores and finish descriptions of them. You can see I included this one in particular just so that you can see it's not all gray-green sediment. We've got a whole submerged soil here full of jarosite and iron concentrations, beautiful redox features within the top meter, but under about 30 or 40 centimeters of what people normally recognize as marine sediment. So very complex things within these systems. I'd like to thank everyone for their attention. Special thanks to my Smithsonian collaborator, Dr. McGonigal, and of course my undergraduate crew, Jacqueline, Kristen, and David. Thank you very much. Thank you, Barry.
Any questions for Barry?
Yes. I don't know what I would call it, but I do think it probably should qualify as a new order. It's sort of unusual, I think, to lump it in with entosols because, like several other orders, entosols just becomes a garbage bin for things that don't fit elsewhere. And I think that subaqueous soils, because they're constantly saturated, and in fact you don't even have leaching as we would normally expect. If anything, you've generally got submarine groundwater discharge, which is a radically different process than we see in most subaerial soils. I think that alone may be worth classifying these as a separate order. But I'm not prepared to formally argue for that. That's just my barely informed opinion on it as a grad student.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Well, this brings to a close the pedology general oral sessions. And we thank our presenters for the excellent presentations. Do we have any announcements to make? Yes, sir. All right, thank you. Well, this session is now adjourned. Thank you very much.